Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Pope and Easter Joy. Pope Benedict urges us to walk in the company of the risen Christ and allow our lives to be transformed by faith in him. Volunteering for Dublin's Eucharistic Congress. Over 2,000 people have volunteered to assist in the smooth running of the upcoming International Eucharistic Congress in Dublin, and we explore the motivations of one such volunteer. And battling the traffickers in Nepal. Thousands of young women and girls from Nepal are trafficked each year to become sex slaves, and we find out how Caritas is trying to prevent this occurring. At his Wednesday general audience, Pope Benedict urged us to walk in the company of the risen Christ and allow our lives to be transformed by faith in him and by the power of his resurrection. Charles Collins reports.
Pope Benedict XVI flew into Rome by helicopter from the papal residence in Castel Gandolfo, where he has been resting after Easter. He was then driven around St. Peter's Square before cheering crowds before beginning his weekly catechesis. Commenting on the menacing clouds which hung overhead, the Pope said that even a gray sky cannot dampen the joy of Easter which resides in the heart.
Dear brothers and sisters, our general audience today is marked by the spiritual joy of Easter, born of the Christ's victory over sin and death. When the risen Lord appeared to the disciples in the upper room, and showed them his saving warmth, their lives were changed. With the gift of the Holy Spirit, Christ gave them the peace which the world cannot give, and sends them forth to bring that peace to the world.
The Pope said Jesus transformed the words of his greeting, "Peace be with you." He said this common greeting now takes on a new meaning because it operates an internal change. It's the Easter greeting which overcomes the fear of the disciples. The peace that Jesus brings is the gift of salvation that he had promised. It is now clear that it's not just a greeting. This peace, purchased by Christ with his blood, is not only for them but for everyone, and the disciples must take it around the world.
The mission of the disciples in August is the journey of the church, the people of the new covenant, called to bear witness in every age to the truth of the resurrection and the new life which it brings. Today, too, the Lord enters our hearts and our homes with his gifts of joy and peace, life and hope.
As an example, he spoke of the two disciples on the road to Emmaus, who recognized Jesus in the breaking of the bread.
Like the disciples on the way to Emmaus, may we recognize his presence among us in his word and in the breaking of the bread. During this Easter season, let us resolve to walk in the company of the risen Christ and allow our lives to be transformed by faith in him and by the power of his resurrection. Upon all saying, speaking visitors present to this audience, especially those from England, Ireland, Sweden, Australia, Canada, and the United States, I invoke the joy and peace of the risen Lord. Happy Easter!
Before the audience, Pope Benedict blessed a mosaic representing the Holy Family. It will be brought to Milan for the World Meeting of Families, which begins on May 30th. At the end of the audience, the Holy Father returned to Castel Gandolfo, where he will stay until Friday. I'm Charles Collins.
Benedict has appointed the prefect of the Congregation for Bishops, Canadian Cardinal Mark Ouellet, to represent him at the International Eucharistic Congress in Dublin this June. The Congress runs from June the 10th to June the 17th, and more than 2,000 people have volunteered to give up their time to assist in the smooth running of the event. One of those volunteers is Julia Vaughan, and she spoke to my colleague Emma McCarthy about the upcoming Congress and her reasons for volunteering.
Well, I am absolutely thrilled to be involved with the Congress because I think it's a wonderful opportunity and it's going to bring great blessings to Ireland. And it's going to be a time of renewal and reconciliation. And to be involved as a volunteer gives you an opportunity of doing something concrete and positive for the church. We've got so many blessings. That evening, before the institution of the Eucharist, Jesus washed the feet of the disciples. And he's asking us to do the same, to be of service to one another and to keep going until we literally drop. It is very important that we give and receive, and that we have a love for one another and an understanding of God's love for us. He is the one who loved us first. And to be part of that and to be an example for others insofar as we can and to bring them with us is the message of the gospel. And it is wonderful that everything is happening on the 50th anniversary as well of the Vatican Council. And that was a wonderful time in the church, and we have to return to it. And our own Archbishop and the Pope were happy that the theme for the Congress was taken from the documents of Vatican II, in particular Lumen Gentium.
Julia, speak to us a little bit about your own local church reality. You're from the Archdiocese of Dublin. What parish do you belong to?
I belong to the parish of Blackrock. And we have an administrator who is John Delaney. He's wonderful. He's a truly God-filled person. And he has a great outreach and capacity to talk with people, to make everybody feel comfortable. And one of the big blessings is fellowship and communion. And it is very lovely to feel that people can enjoy a cup of tea and they feel part of our church. We have engaged in all of the activities. We had the bell recently, and that was a wonderful experience, and it brought people together. We have adoration in our church, and during Lent we've had concelebrated Mass at 7:30 on every Thursday, followed by adoration for a half an hour. This brings people to a realization of what the outreach from the Congress must be. The Mass in particular is so important, and we have engaged in a realization of the different stages of presentation: the introductory rite, the rite of the word, and the rite of the Eucharist. And that is so precious. Eucharistic adoration is something that has been encouraged and has been part of all congresses over the years. And in Ireland and in Dublin, there is a huge emphasis on Eucharistic adoration and to rekindle what used to be. We used to have 40 hours adoration in churches, and that must come back. But people can only take and be nourished gently, and that is happening in particular in our area. And we've been encouraging volunteers from our church and people to host families from abroad who need help during the Congress. And they are only too delighted to do that.
Can you take us back to when you first heard that Dublin was going to be the host city for the next edition of the 50th edition of the International Eucharistic Congresses? What was your reaction?
My reaction was huge because I really have a great love for the church, for the outreach that is necessary to bring people together. And when I was asked at a meeting to be a representative for our church, oh, I thought, what? At that time, I had just signed up to do a theology course, and I thought, what does this involve, and how much time? And I thought, oh, it's crossing him. But within 5 minutes, I said, right. And my first encounter with Father Kevin was when there was a group established to meet in the south side of Dublin representing the parishes there. And he gave us a rundown of what was happening and laid emphasis on the input from Vatican II, in the sense that our Archbishop had looked at the possibility of themes and drew from Lumen Gentium, communion with Christ and with one another. And this was accepted by the Holy Father. And the Holy Father, actually, when he announced that the Congress would be in Dublin, he announced that at the last Congress in Quebec in 2008. And his words at that time was that he would hope that it would be a time of renewal for the Irish Church. And then looking into the background to Congresses and the fact that Congresses are controlled by a committee from the Vatican, led by Archbishop Marini, through his scripts were vitalizing. And I think I just felt this is what Ireland needs, though many felt it was the wrong time. With hindsight, it was a blessing. And it was the intervention of the Lord, I think, as he always has done in history. When the church is in trouble, we need something to bring us back. And this Congress is what this is going to do.
Now let's jump forward, perhaps, Julia. We're really counting down the last days to Congress. There's just under 2 months to the beginning of Congress now in Dublin. And as I said earlier, you are one of the 2,000 people who have answered the call to be volunteers for this Congress. You have been busily preparing over the last 2 years. Perhaps you could talk to us a little bit about your role as a volunteer.
Well, I have been engaged with representing my parish, so that has, of necessity, required a lot of time. In addition, being a volunteer in general, I go into the Congress office to help out there, and you meet so many people when you speak to them on the telephone, communicating, asking that they would come and attend the training sessions, that they would fill in their documentation correctly, etc., etc. So you have the facility to talk to many of different ages and to assess where they're at and to encourage them. And many are dithering, and while they would have given their names initially, they might be reneging, but somehow with conversation about where we're going and what we're doing, and how they may be able to help in a very positive way, we gain their acceptance, and it's lovely. There are many, many strands to be dealt with and many communications that have to take time and patience and understanding. Some people will come in their own time. Some people are reticent and they are loath to give us their time, and they don't fully understand what is required. So all of that is what I try to piece together.
Can you speak to us perhaps about the type of people who are volunteering? How many different people from different backgrounds, age groups, etc., etc.?
Well, you'll be surprised to know that I was at one of the training sessions last Saturday facilitating, and I met two gentlemen, one who was 1 year old at the last Congress and the other who was 4 year old at the last Congress. And I marvelled that they were prepared to be present for 5 days during the Congress. And I said, will you be able for the hours? Yes, most certainly we will. So that really shows what determination, strength of purpose, and obviously God-filled lives can engender. There are many people who are young students and are giving of their summer vacation. Other people are nurses, doctors, etc., who have taken the week off at their own expense. Many are from the country, and they are coming up to find accommodation in Dublin and are delighted to give up their time to this great cause.
Julia, what are your hopes for this Congress?
My hope for this Congress is that the true spirit and theme of the Congress will become a reality for all. Communion with Christ and with one another. And that really means being all things to all men, to have a love for people, and to realise that we are all temples of the Holy Spirit. We receive the Spirit of baptism, we're empowered by it at confirmation, and we are fed and nourished by the bread of life. The institution of the Eucharist must bring home to us the reality of what the Eucharist is about, one of the main aims of the Congress. And if we are fed and nourished by the Eucharist, we become what we receive. And in becoming what we receive, we give that out to others. We're more understanding of other people if we see them as temples of the Holy Spirit. So reconciliation should flow, we hope, from this Congress.
That was volunteer Julia Vaughan speaking to Emma McCarthy. More than 15,000 young women and girls are trafficked from Nepal each year to become sex slaves. Many of them end up in Indian brothels, and around half of them are minors. Other young people from Nepal are trafficked to work as maids or labourers, either in Gulf countries or in South Asian nations. The Catholic Church's Caritas Internationalis Confederation is at the forefront of efforts to prevent these vulnerable Nepalese people from becoming the prey of the unscrupulous people traffickers. Laura Sheehan is a communications officer for Caritas who has just returned from a fact-finding visit to Nepal. I began by asking her whether the trafficking problem in that country is getting worse or better.
From what I've seen, the human trafficking situation in Nepal is staying about the same. The traffickers keep changing their tactics as groups like us keep changing our prevention efforts. So it's an ongoing battle.
One of the most horrific aspects of this trafficking is that many of these young girls are trafficked into the sex trade, primarily in India. And I gather that, is it true that most of them are still minors?
Quite a few of the young women that I met with who had almost been trafficked and had been saved were minors, 16 years old, 17 years old, 13 years old. I even heard from a lawyer about one girl who was 10 years old and her male teacher had told her, let's take a trip to India and, you know, see the movie theaters there. So these are very young girls and girls who are often from small rural villages and really just don't know what's out there.
One of the most disturbing aspects is that often these traffickers are friends of the family or even acquaintances or, as you say, in that case, a teacher. I mean, it makes it very disturbing, doesn't it, that people are so willing to do this awful thing just for the sake of some money.
It's really appalling that people who know these girls fairly well are willing to sell them, you know, sell them into a horrible, degrading life just for the sake of money. And in some cases, not even a lot of money. I met a girl who was 16 and her next door neighbor was going to sell her to another trafficker for about 50 euros. So it was such a small amount of money.
Now, I know that you spoke to some of the people who did, of course, get kidnapped and became victims of this trade. And you spoke to one of these victims, whose name was Charimaya, who, interestingly, managed afterwards to prosecute the person who trafficked her. Can you tell us very briefly some of the bare bones of her story, how she got trafficked and how she was treated?
Yes, her story is really remarkable. She's the first woman I've ever met who, when she was taken by the traffickers, sort of knew what was happening. Most of the young girls I talk to, they just don't know what's going on. They don't know that people are lying to them and cheating them. This girl, she was a teenager when it happened. She was basically abducted by these men. She was in a field. They grabbed her. They made her swallow powder, which turned out to be some sort of drug that made her fall unconscious, and took her eventually to a brothel in India. And she spent almost 2 years in this brothel.
How was she treated then?
She was treated very badly. She was abused. She was this young girl who just didn't know what was happening. She just felt desperate and she hated it. It's just so impressive that when she got back to Nepal, when the brothel was raided, she immediately started trying to help other women that this had happened to. And she was one of the first women to prosecute her trafficker and actually sent him to jail. She's very brave and remarkable.
Yet I gather, though, when she went back home and she went to a home village, she was treated as an outcast by most of the people there. That must be so wounding, and I gather it must happen quite a lot, doesn't it?
This police raid that happened in India that freed her and many, many other Nepali women resulted in this sort of influx of women coming back to Nepal, and many of them had a very hard time going back to their villages. And it was very heartbreaking that Charimaya herself was sort of rejected by the people she had grown up with.
It's almost as though the victims are treated as though they were the criminal.
Exactly. And that's one thing that she and other people and groups like Caritas are trying to fight. You know, we're trying to say these women are not criminals. You know, they are the victims. They are the ones who were hurt and abused and used. They are not the people who should be behind bars. You know, the traffickers are the ones that we have to fight and put in jail.
Now, awareness raising must be crucial to trying to stop yet more young, innocent girls from falling into this trap, from believing the traffickers and not falling into their clutches in the first place. I know that this particular ex-victim, Charimaya, is doing quite a lot of work on that front, isn't she? And also Caritas. Can you tell us something about that?
Yes, Charimaya is actually a resource person for Caritas, which means that she goes to churches and schools and talks to groups of students, boys and girls, about the realities out there and some of the risks that are out there. One thing to know is that it's not just women who are young girls who are being exploited this way. There are very young men, say 17 years old, who are sort of tricked by employment agents into going abroad, say to Malaysia or Kuwait, to do construction work or to make furniture, and they're not paid, and they have to sleep in horrible conditions, and they're basically slaves for many months, so that there are all sorts of kinds of exploitation happening to all age groups, and so Caritas is working hard to get the word out about the different tricks that these criminals can play.
And apart from these girls who end up in the sex trade, there is also people, women and men, who go to the Gulf countries to work as housemaids or similar. I mean, what percentage of them are abused or at any rate mistreated during their employment?
There are tens of thousands of, especially women, who are going to Gulf countries like Saudi Arabia. Many of them are treated well. They're paid the money they've been told they'll be paid. But some are treated shockingly badly by their employers. They live in private houses. They work for a family. But they're treated like animals. They're not fed. They're locked in, often beaten. I've talked to women who were housemaids in the Gulf, and they were, you know, locked in a dark closet for 2 or 3 days. So some really bad stuff is going on behind the scenes, and it's very heartbreaking.
And, of course, these women who go are often married women with children of their own. I mean, what impact is this having on so many Nepalese children who are now having to grow up without their mother because the mother is abroad earning this money in other countries?
It's been really hard on families in general. It's hard when your spouse is away for 2 years, you know, whether you're a woman or a man. If you're trying to raise kids by yourself, it's really hard. There are situations where the man goes away for 2 years and comes back and has HIV. There are situations where the children are left with grandparents or aunts and uncles who just aren't able to take very good care of them. Or in some cases, for example, the aunt might show preference to her own children in terms of food, in terms of who goes to school, in terms of who does the hardest chores on the farm. So it's really a sad situation. And I saw so many little kids in the villages in Nepal where I went. There'd be a group of kids and I would say, who of you has a parent who's abroad? And, you know, a third of them would raise their hand and they'd say, my mother's in Kuwait, or my mother's in Saudi Arabia, or my father's in Malaysia. And these are fairly long-term contracts, at least a year or two. So they're, you know, they don't see their parent for quite some time.
So when you talk to these people, either the people who went to work in the Gulf countries or, as you say, these former victims of the sex trade, were there any particular remarks that they made that really resonated with you, that brought home to you the shocking reality of the experiences they've been through?
What was really painful for me to hear was how guilty so many of these people felt because they had not brought back the money they thought they would. They had usually borrowed from friends or neighbors, borrowed enormous sums to pay an unscrupulous employment agent, and then they weren't paid abroad, and they came back and they still owed these massive sums. They felt guilty because they just hadn't brought back the money. Another thing that was disturbing was how the girls or the boys just felt ashamed about how they'd been tricked, as if it was their fault. I remember one boy who worked in Malaysia for free for many months because of an unscrupulous employment agent. He was saying, well, it's my fault for not being more aware. And I said, it's the trafficker's fault. It's the employment agent's fault. You know, you were the one who was mistreated. So that really stuck in my head, the way these people just felt guilt and shame about what had happened.
We've been focusing in here on the victims of human trafficking and those who got sucked up into this trade. But have there been some success stories, people who either managed to realize what was happening or escape their employers?
Well, one thing that made me very happy to hear was we were in a sort of slum area near a town in eastern Nepal, and there was a girl, 16 years old, who had been approached by a neighbor who said, you know, I'll process your passport, I'm going to get you a good job abroad, don't tell your father, I'll tell your father, basically don't tell your family. So the girl didn't tell her family, she went to get her photos taken, she realized that her identification documents were being made out in a false name, and that worried her, and she told her friend. The friend told another neighbor, and this neighbor had been taught in a Caritas course to look for certain signs, you know, anything suspicious. And this neighbor approached the family and said, do you know your daughter's about to go abroad? And the family stopped it. They realized there was a problem. And what really impressed me was that this woman who had gone to the Caritas information session had said that a year ago, before she went to the session, if she had heard that this girl was going abroad for work, she would have thought it was a good idea that the girl would make good money for her family. It was only because of the Caritas course that she was suspicious and worried about it and went to the family. And I think it was a very clear-cut case of trafficking. So it's great that that girl was saved.
Now, you said that Caritas is involved in awareness-raising sessions to warn people. Can you tell us how extensive that is and what other things they do to try and stop people becoming victims of this very sordid trade?
Yes, the awareness-raising sessions in schools, in refugee camps, in churches. We're allying ourselves also with different religious groups. We're, you know, Caritas has groups that include Hindu nuns. We're really trying to reach as many people as possible through these info sessions. We also have radio shows where survivors talk and are interviewed. We have lawyers talking on this show. We have little radio jingles on popular folk rock stations warning people about what's happening. And then one thing we're doing for women is giving small loans so that if they can and want to start a small home-based business in their village in Nepal, for example, raising chickens or running a little tea and donut shop, they can run that business and earn money where they live so they can stay with their families so that they don't have to take these very dubious job offers.
Because poverty is at the root of this, isn't it? But people wouldn't even accept these offers if they weren't so desperately poor.
Exactly. There's so little opportunity in these rural areas of Nepal. There's just nothing you can do to earn money. And you want your kids to go to school and you want your kids to have a good life. So even if you know that this agent seems a little strange, that this person offering employment doesn't seem quite right, you're willing to take the chance because you want to help your kids or you want to help the rest of your family, and there's just no other way to earn any money.
I was speaking to Laura Sheehan of Caritas Internationalis. Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.